Welcome everybody.
Jumping will be the best way to cross, to intertwine our...
Okay, so that's what we're doing. We're warning you that we're going to jump from topic to topic because we haven't really planned an agenda exactly, although I think we have several intertwined concerns. So I'm very pleased to have both seminars here together, and I'm especially pleased to have a brief chance to have a public conversation with Giorgio, who I've actually known for quite some time now. Some of your very first books were sent to me when they were being translated into English. I received The Coming Community, and they said, "Do you think that we should publish this?" I said, "Yeah, I really think we should publish it." I don't know why I got sent it, but I was thrilled. I remember the day I read it. I read it all in a single setting. In any case, I think that it might be interesting for us to talk a little bit about the problem of the subject, or the problem of action. We heard the other night an account of liturgy which implied a certain relationship between the office and public action, and I think that would be quite interesting to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I thought it's possible that we could think about action in Arendt, or maybe there's some way in which these two versions could speak to one another. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
No, as your seminar was on Arendt, and the lecture was on Arendt, perhaps one of the first thing I feel I have to say, perhaps concerning this, concerns this peculiar liturgy, which is a trial, Eichmann trial.
Yeah.
Here we have a juridical liturgy. And then, of course, the strong connection I tried to suggest between the notion of office and the character, the person of Eichmann, no? Who spoke officialese, no? The only language he knew was officialese,
Anna
Arendt,
invented
this term.
That's right.
But then, I don't know if you have seen the movie The Specialist, which was done with the huge quantity of films were filmed, you say, mm-hmm. During the process. And this man, Eyal Sival, made a film of 2 hours with all this incredibly interesting material.
Is that Eyal Sivan?
Sivan.
Yes, okay, I know him.
Eyal Sivan. Yeah.
Yes, okay.
He's an Israeli.
Yes, he is.
Interesting
guy. That's right. And he lives in Paris,
perhaps. And now he doesn't live anymore in Paris because the Jewish activist burned his office. So now he lives in
the right wing Jewish.
He lives.
Just want to make sure because the left wing.
Of course. And now he lives in London. So the incredible impression I have on this movie, seeing this film, is that Eichmann is a man of the law. And he presents himself as something who will obey the law in the special form that the law took in Nazi Germany, so implying also the voice of the Führer, etc., etc. But then he will present himself just as a man of the law. On the other part, the prosecutor. In this process, there is a prosecutor who seems perfectly to correspond to Eichmann, is the counterpart, is the other face of the law, but completely similar to him. So what struck me incredibly, so Eichmann was at ease each time that the problem became a problem of bureaucracy, mm-hmm. Order, numbers. The office number is continuously referring to the number which defines his office. I don't remember K K2001-42A, and so, and also all the papers of the process were classified in that way, so the prosecutor will also very often say, let's now take the paper B3044, and Eichmann knew it perfectly. He had seen all the material of the process, the papers, so he was completely at ease, and immediately that the situation became this, he felt at ease. So I had the impression, and as Anna Arendt puts in the beginning, the house of the where the place where the trial was celebrated was in Hebrew is Bet HaMishpat, meaning the house of judgment. Not the house of justice, as she translates.
Mm.
It's the house. Yes, Ivan told me this is not the house of judgment. It's the house of judgment.
I see.
So it was the place where judgment was done. The judgment was being in course. And I really had the impression to that Eichmann and the prosecutor were the two faces of this mystery of the law, this mystery of the law, the mystery of punishment and fault, no, was being there. So also Anna Arendt gives the impression of having not feel at all at ease with the way this process was done. But when you see this film, you have an even stronger uneasiness, impression of really embarrassment, no? Because we are entire in the domain of Eichmann.
Mm.
Eichmann is completely at ease there. The prosecutor is perfectly corresponds to him, and we see so this horrible mystery of the law showing itself in all its their aspects. No? So I understand that Anna Arendt could have been not at ease this.
Yeah. You know, she refers to the trial again and again as a kind of spectacle or as a show. And I'm just wondering how that dimension of trials, the kind of public spectacle, would correspond to this idea of a kind of juridical liturgy.
Yeah. My impression was not of a spectacle, but more, seeing the material, of this the liturgy of law. Liturgy of law. It was really in a domain where Eichmann was at its right place. At its right place. And this is very embarrassing to see this. No? You see the inadequacy to the law to the problem of the law to the problem.
Mm.
The problem of Eichmann there is reduced to its juridical aspect. Even there are all this attempt to enlarge into a wider problem. But each time, from this language of B245, let's take now paper. It's completely inside this dimension.
Right.
This dimension. So that you feel a strong inadequacy of what has happened there to the problem.
And I mean, I'm just wondering that if one takes seriously your conception of the mystery, the mystery of the law and its and how that works with its administrative reductionism, right? Or its ridiculousness, its administrative ridiculousness. Does it leave open
ridiculous and tragic?
Yes, ridiculous and tragic. Consequential ridiculousness. In your view, does Arendt's concerns with the question of legitimate law and illegitimate law, how would that work in your view? I mean, could you raise the question of legitimate law or illegitimate law? Or are you saying that legitimate and illegitimate law alike participate in a certain kind of mystery of law by virtue of living out the liturgical tradition, and that they are more alike than we would like to think?
Yeah, when I employed this expression, the mystery of law, I refer to a very beautiful book by written by an Italian jurist. The book is called The Mystery of the Process, because this great jurist, his idea is that the reality, the truth of law is the process. It's not the norm. Usually we see, especially in Europe, to the law as a system of norm. Mm. He says, no, this is not the essence of law. The essence of law is the process. So the judgment and the process. Mm. And he employs this expression, the mystery of the process. So the process is, that's in some way, if we now we take the point of view of liturgy, a kind of mystery in the sense of a castle. Something is, it's an action, something is being doing, and this operation is the truth of law. Mm-hmm. So if now you try to distinguish in the process what is legitimate, the real categories is the two that Schmitt employs, no? Legality and legitimacy. Mm. This, according to this distinction, legality and legitimacy do not coincide, so there can be something which is legal, but which is not legitimate. But this is a theoretical statement, because then, when you practically are in the system of law, for instance, where the Nazi law legal? Yes, they were. But then, if something is legal, how to pose the problem of its legitimacy? From a juridical point of view, it's not easy, especially if you are an entirely positive system. Mm-hmm. You can only ask the problem of the constitutionality. Mm-hmm. Are there consequent to the constitution of that country? Mm-hmm. It's the only way to pose it today, a question of legitimacy. But from if you take from the contrary point another different standard, much older, like when the state had not the monopoly of law, then you can pose from a juridical point of view the problem of the legitimacy of a legal law. But today it's not easy to do it. So in Arendt term, how to really? But I think you said that she takes a position outside the law.
Yeah, I think
she speaks from a moral
point of view. I think it's from a moral point of view.
Because from a juridical point of view, today it has become very difficult. While in the juridical tradition on Western civilization, many times, because you can have from a religious, juridical point of view, there was the idea of a natural law, divine law, from which you can judge the legitimacy of a law. But today, as the state has the monopoly of the law, where you can find the juridical instance outside. And also the jurists are less and less able to do this. No? In the juridical tradition of Western country, the figure of the jurist was also one who could say, this law apparently is legal, but according to the principle of law, it's not a consequence. No? But now even this idea that there are some principle of mm-hmm. law mm-hmm. that should not be contradicted is very often dismissed.
I'm wondering if we could talk about Kafka for a minute. Mm. Because it seems to me that the way you're describing law as process and as judgment.
This is Kafka idea.
Yes, but also the way you're characterizing systems of law as not having kind of adequate grounding outside themselves, no recourse to legitimating norms that would be able to say when and where a legal system is illegitimate. Of course, that could lead us to a kind of radically Kafkian position, if we could call it that, whereby there are effectively judgments happening all the time, but they they have a tenuous relation to the person to whom they are addressed, and there are functionaries who carry them, but they very often carry them to the wrong place. Or one tries to penetrate the law, one tries to enter into the house of the law, only to find that the staircases don't lead anywhere, or that one goes round and round.
In Kafka, no, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know...
Yeah, there is no house of...
There's no house of the law.
Or it's everywhere, because it's in a laundry. You know, sometimes it's in a laundry.
Yes.
By the end, there is a laundry, but this is the house of the law.
But it seems to me, if we took this position... And maybe there's a way in which Kafka resonates with Schmidt for you. I don't know whether you see the... It would be interesting and awkward if that were true, but... Does it actually make you despair of law? Does it make you think we can't look to law? Or does it make you think we must look to law, or we're always looking to law even when we don't know we're looking to law? Because on the one hand, it seems that that there's no reason to have any faith in law. On the other hand, it seems to me you're saying that the entire system of liturgical faith is actually precisely what keeps law going. So I'm just wondering if how far you go with this. I mean, do you despair of legal debate? Do you despair of the law as a sometimes adequate recourse to address issues of justice? Do you understand justice as outside the law?
So the house of judgment and the house of justice probably do not coincide.
Yes.
The house of judgment. And if it's true that the process is the core of the law, no? And I think this is Kafka's point of view. I think that the process, Kafka's process, shows that he thinks that the process is the core of the law, is the law,
mm-hmm.
because then there is a process. But this process is in a complete, it's completely undetermined. It has not even been accused. It's not clear up to the end if it has really been accused.
Yes.
Yeah, you remember, because
yes.
They said, we didn't really accuse you. The Kafka ideas is that law is something in which man, subject, gets involved
mm-hmm.
by himself.
Mm-hmm.
No, it is clear that from the moment that the two men came to him, then it's him, only him, who tries to have the process be done.
Mm-hmm.
It's always the Joseph Kahn who seeks for the law, goes to the house of judgment, and it's what the priest finally tells him. No, and finally, the process asks nothing from you. If you come, he accepts you. If you don't remember the words of that, I think that law is something of that nature. No, I'm not cannot be minimalized, because it's evident that first it's there. We in the beginning it's already there, but then the problem is why men get involved in it. Why men get involved in it, and. I think even as far as the process is concerned, a friend of mine discovered a very interesting thing. Do you remember that the book begins, someone had to have a community, how do you say? Falsely accused.
Yes, someone is falsely
calumniated.
Yes, someone must have falsely accused.
Yeah, but what's the English term for this, falsely accused? No. Accused falsely. Calumniating.
Yes, calumny.
No, but there is another English term, I think. Not for that.
Yes,
there is no.
I can't
so,
remember.
So, it is, this, so in Latin, this was called calumnia.
Yes, calumny.
Written with
calumny.
Calumny.
Yeah.
So, accusing, starting falsely a process.
yes,
accusing someone falsely.
Yes.
This was called calumnia, ka, with written ka. And as the Roman process began always with an accusation, the way in which process began, perhaps today also, it didn't change a lot, a process in Rome began that someone accused someone, inscribed the name of the accused in a list. So the process depended on this accusation. The accusation was the starting of the process. So the calumnia, the false accused,
yes,
was a great problem because it made the process begin without reason, falsely. So the calumnia was felt in the Roman system law as a great problem, a great crime. And the punishment was the inscription of a ka on the front of the calumniator, can we say, the falsely calumniator, the one who falsely accuses,
yes,
someone.
We probably need that whole phrase, yeah.
And so the idea so is that Joseph K. does not mean Joseph Kafka, as everyone always suggested. Max Brod was the first to say K. is always Kafka. No, K. means the calumniator, the one who, the calumny, because the book begins, someone had calumniator, falsely accused. But then, as if Joseph K. is the one who makes the accusation, this means that each man falsely accuses himself. I think that this was Kafka's idea. The law is grounded in the fact that each man calumniates himself.
Yes. Well,
and Joseph K. yeah, makes this all the time, because he goes there, goes,
yes,
seeks for the judge, seeks for the process.
Yes.
He's falsely, he's really, he has the ka on the front.
He has the ka. Well, but the, you know, I mean, the other way of reading that, of course, is to suggest that one's own name, or even the trace of one's name, carries a kind of false accusation. In other words, that to be named is always to be named from...
To be named is to be accused.
Is to be accused. And it's also to carry some ineffable guilt from another place and time. So I'm thinking, for instance, when Arendt writes her introduction to Walter Benjamin's Illuminations, and she refers to Benjamin's reading of Kafka, she says that the important point of this for Benjamin has to do with the way in which law is transmitted over time, that there is no, that it gets transmitted in an arbitrary way. It gets transmitted through it from the past.
So there is even a sickness of transmission.
Yes, there's a sickness of transmission. It suddenly appears. We don't know where it appears from. There's no single authority or no chain of authorities through which it is passed. And Arendt actually likes this moment, where the law kind of reemerges in flashes or in momentary upsurges that seem absurd, but which suggest that there are exoteric ways that the law is transmitted, that it's, we can't find a single authority who can and does transmit the law. So I'm thinking here about that process of transmission, and wondering whether some guilt from another time and place suddenly lands on his forehead, that he lives, he's carrying a tradition unconsciously or unknowingly, or it is carrying him or afflicting him in ways that we can't trace, right? So there's a process of transmission that is finally not traceable. And I'm just thinking that that might be a kind of a particular idea about the Jewish transmission of law that might be a little different from the liturgical one that you've been looking at. And of course, Kafka is perfect for you in the sense that, you know, he had that miserable office job, you know, and it exhausted him. And he was terribly good at it. It was unfortunate. But if you read his diaries, he's just exhausted every night coming back from that office, and it wore him down. And of course, the office appears throughout the literature as well. But I'm just wondering, is there a different model of transmission that we might... I mean, is there more than one model of transmission?
What Benjamin says with respect to Kafka in the essay is that the position in which Kafka is that there is a transmission, but no more something to be transmitted.
Yes.
Remember, no?
Yes.
So, and this is Benjamin's diagnosis about our situation, in a way. We have a tradition which transmits nothing.
Yes.
Which there is nothing to transmit. No? So the discussion about the law with the Scholem, no? it's what Scholem called this the zero point of the law, where the law is there but has no content.
Mm. Mm.
So, I think we are. I used to say that this would be a good description of our situation with respect to tradition. We have a tradition, but this tradition really does not tell us clearly as a tradition should be. You know? There is nothing to be transmitted. And,
but do you think there are different modes of transmission? Do you think, or do you presume that the Christian formulation of liturgy has actually, in some sense, totalized the field, that it's what's operating in all modes of transmission at this point?
No, I think there are many.
There are many.
I don't know which one are really effective today.
Yeah.
I don't think that we are going back to Benjamin's idea, I think that we are also in a situation of sickness of tradition.
Yes.
Benjamin's idea was that in Kafka, the transmission rebelled against
yes.
the thing to be transmitted. No?
Yes.
Remember, it takes these two concept of Jewish tradition, halacha and agada. Halacha is the law, mm-hmm. agada are the stories.
Mm-hmm.
The Talmud is made with the enunciation of law and the little stories.
Yes.
And it says that what in Kafka happens is that the agada gives
a punch.
Revolts against the halakha.
Halakha. Yeah.
So, but in a certain way, the halakha is the thing to be transmitted, the law is the thing to be transmitted, and the agada should be the way of the transmission, the narration.
Mm.
And I think we are a little in this. We have a transmission, but nothing to be transmitted.
Yes.
I don't know if this is your idea.
So we can open this up to other questions. I mean, I'm still interested in whether there's justice beyond the law, whether you kind of accept kind of Derrida's reading of Benjamin's critique of violence, whether you would posit justice beyond the law. I mean, you've suggested to us that, you know, whatever the extraordinary atrocity that Eichmann committed, it couldn't be adequately addressed by the law. At least I think that's what you're saying, that the law is a...
The impression you got in the process was this.
Yes,
this was
that was the massive incommensurability.
And everything was inside the mystery
yes.
of the process and nothing could be outside.
But I'm wondering whether something like justice is irrecoverable, whether that's like... the content that used to be transmitted but which no longer exists, whether justice becomes a lost or scattered concept or whether you hold out for it.
There's this beautiful thing again that Benjamin writes in the essay on Kafka, referring to the fact that the Jewish only studied the law. He said, a law which is no more applied but only studied is the door of justice.
Is the door of justice.
So the implication is that justice just has to do with a kind of neutralization of the law. If the law is made inoperative, so no more applied, then you have justice, which is a strange thing. So then, But I think that there is something, I don't think that justice can never coincide with applied law, but perhaps with the inoperativity and abeyance of law, perhaps yes.
I see. Please, Tim.
Following on this statement that you just made about the exceptional situation of Eichmann, and this is addressed to both of you, do you support the death penalty for Eichmann in Eichmann's case, or in any case, and are there exceptions? And if not, then what would you have them do with him, or what would you have done with him?
I feel like we're on German television in 1964. I said, I feel like we're on German television in 1964, you know, because we saw this interview with Arendt. Should I respond in German, or should I?
I do not support any form of punishment, so I have no opinion. I'm not against the punishment exists, or the processes are there, but I do not support any form of punishment.
I can't. Any form of punishment or any form of capital punishment, the death penalty?
No, any form of punishment.
Any form of punishment.
The penalty. If it depended on me, I should invent something more interesting than punishment. But this, I'm not saying from this that the people must not be punished. It's not a position against process to criminals. But if I have to say really what I think, I cannot support any form of punishment. Prison, how can I be for prison? How can I be for death penalty? It's possible.
So you're saying you're not in support of any form of punishment that we've come up with until this point?
Pardon?
It sounds like you're saying you're in favor of the principle of punishment, but not in any form of punishment that human beings have come up with until this point.
No, it's in favor of a system where punishment should not happen. So you cannot ask me to support punishment, but I'm not denying that in the society we are living, you have to punish people. But this I can't support. You can ask me to say prison is good, death penalty is good, torture is good, or whatever.
Okay. I don't support capital punishment. I don't. And I probably would not have supported it for Eichmann either, even though I understand in some ways what the passion for that was. But I think that when one is in the grip of that passion, the passion to see a heinous criminal die, that's a passion that has to be negotiated. It has to be worked through to some other kind of conclusion.
Right. Especially since he asked for it.
Yes, well, even, you know, I would say no matter what he said,
right.
No matter whether he asked for it or protested against it, I think that maybe one has to work with those passions for to see destruction, to have destruction done in that way. I think one has to limit one's passion. One has to sober up. I think there can be an intoxication with killing. My worry is that so many people find moral justifications for the intoxicated destructiveness that they wish to pursue. So, and that's, I think, a profoundly Nietzschean problem with law, and one I think always has to ask whether there's a kind of festival of cruelty going on in the making and implementing of law, even as law understands itself as somehow transcending that domain of cruelty or that domain of barbarism. So we have to ask about the barbarism of the highly moralized law. I think that has to be countered in all kinds of ways.
I think that any person trying to morally justify punishment, not only death penalty, but any penalty. You can accept that they exist, but if you try to morally justify them, This is a crime.
This is a crime. But a crime according to which law? Open question. The law that we're studying. Yeah. Okay. Do you want to call up Jake? And we'll take you back there afterwards.
You both just spoke about naming as an accusation. But earlier, we were talking with you about naming as being something people desire and something that is important for someone to be recognized.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm just wondering if that it's not so simple to see naming as simply an accusation. There's a certain desire to be named.
Well, I think in Kafka it works that way because he's talking about a certain kind of nameless transmission of guilt. But maybe one way of answering your question is to say that even when we want to be called a name, or even when we name ourselves in some way, or we offer a name to another, much more is working through that name than we know. In other words, there's more history burdened in the name or encrypted in the name than we ourselves can know. So naming perhaps has to be understood as an act of transmission, and it gets subject to the same liabilities that any process of transmission does.
Yeah, and then perhaps happiness is beyond name.
Happiness is beyond name?
Real, complete happiness. If we had imagined a complete happiness, I think it would be beyond the name.
This is also
a Benjamin idea. Benjamin says the nature is sad because it has been overnamed. Named and overnamed.
Mm.
Because any name is also an overnomination.
Mm.
So I think that I agree with you that there is something of an accusation in the name. Even then there is a lot of history which is transmitted in the name, of course. And, I mean, a completely happy place. I'm always fascinated. There is an Arab Platonic philosopher, Al-Farabi, who worked on politics. He wrote a book called The Happy City. He said, what is an happy city? Of course, an happy city is a happy city where there are no doctors, no lawyers, of course, and perhaps also no names.
No names.
Just before Pope John Paul died, he insisted, or he was very...
The last Pope.
John Paul II.
Yeah.
Just before he died, he was very adamant or insistent, although he wouldn't have the power to choose, that Ratzinger became the next Pope.
Mm-hmm. And was against or for?
Was for. Very adamant that Ratzinger would become the next Pope. Is there some sort of... almost kind of symbolic gesture in the idea that a Polish man is encouraging the last living ties to the to a Nazi era, because Ratzinger was a member of the Nazi Youth, although we can imagine his report card, you know, refuses to participate in genocide. On a symbolic level, and I'm not saying that Germany needs on the world stage this absolution, but if it ever was to be held against them, I mean, was the making of Ratzinger the new Pope a kind of symbolic gesture that Germany itself doesn't have to always be held responsible for the actions in the Second World War?
From the fact that I work and make investigation on theology, liturgy, the history of the Church, you must not get the impression that I am an expert on Vatican business. Not at all. So I know nothing about this.
Well, I'll tell you what I know, which is kind of peculiar, which is that before Ratzinger was the Pope, he actually was writing the encyclicals on the family. And he was working
for the Pope.
Yes, for the Pope. And he came out very strongly against gay marriages. He came out very strongly against certain forms of feminism. He came out very strongly as well against the idea that gender might be multiplied beyond two. He actually made a public statement that there were some people who were saying that there are five genders and that he was opposed. He's also the one who formulated the idea that gender is a code word for homosexuality and opposed the UN efforts to convene the Council on the Status of Women on the topic of gender. So I actually think, I mean, there are many issues with Ratzinger, but I think that the Vatican decided to take on some of these social issues, not that that's the only reason. I think we've also seen, since Ratzinger has become Pope, a series of other issues where Holocaust deniers in South America were nevertheless given forgiveness or allowed back into the fold after they had been excommunicated from the fold, and so we actually, I think, are seeing this whole issue about not about Germany. I don't think it's about Germany. I think it is about how to tell history or what kind of history is tellable, and a relationship to revisionism that is not fixed, that's not clear. It may also have to do with the Vatican's own implication in that period of time. I think we probably have to have a kind of broader framework to understand the multiple fronts on which the Vatican is acting, both in the former administration and the present one.
In the natural world, things aren't punished, they perish. And I find that sort of interesting that we, it's maybe, and this is more of a question, like, is it a fear of death, of the perishing, that makes us insist upon the punishment? And then how that would relate to a sense of vengeance, you know,
I don't see really, there is not any analogy, only metaphoric, for the fact that you're saying that in nature things perish, and the juridical trial, which has an accusation and a judgment, there is nothing in nature of this kind. The fact that there is a process and things perish, there is no fault, no accusation, no judge, no judgment, and no punishment. Mm-hmm. You don't see any. This is just a metaphor. And I still believe, and to go back to the problem of accusation, perhaps accusation is really the foundation of law. Because the word accusation comes from the Latin causa. And causa, cause, in the beginning was the thing in debate, the thing about people are fighting, you know, so the juridical conflict, not the juridical conflict. And this, so the accusation is the beginning of this, the moment where someone is captured in the legal system, and you should never forget also that the devil is the accuser. Mm. Diabolos means the accuser. Mm. And there is a nice history in Jewish tradition. It's that after the judgment has done, the last judgment has done, God calls the devil and he tells to him, now I judge yourself because you are the accuser. You accuse the man of this. You accuse the list, all the accusations the devil has done. That also, it's fun that the devil answered, but this I made for you. But I mean, I'm still convinced that the accusation is something very important, very strong, it's more important than the fault. Because fault comes after the accusation, not before. Mm-hmm. Once you have been accused, fault begins. Mm-hmm. So we should think about it.
You know, it's interesting, as I've been reading Arendt recently, it occurs to me that she doesn't actually ever think about the violence of judgment itself, or even the violence of accusation itself. It's a kind of profoundly, it's against Nietzsche, for instance. She wants to make sure there can be judgment, you know, and of course this raises the question of the relationship between accusation and judgment. The act of sentencing is both accusation and final judgment.
Yeah, there is no judgment without an accusation.
There is no judgment without an accusation. Of course, you know, the other end of this, and maybe this goes back to the question about natural process, you know, in Nietzsche's On the Genealogy of Morals, when he talks about the development of the institution of punishment, he describes a situation where we inflict pain or we suffer, but we don't yet ask who is responsible for our suffering, or we do not yet assume responsibility for the suffering of others. So it's only through transforming suffering into injury that the accusation becomes possible, and we hold subjects accountable for the injuries that they do. But the real question for me, and I think it's actually one that Benjamin also raises in various places, is not whether we can, I mean, I'm sure that I feel very strongly that we do need modes of accountability, right? I doubt very much that the Eichmann trial was the best way to hold Eichmann accountable. So I'm not against modes of accountability at all. And yet, I wonder whether by taking the juridical framework as the exclusive or even the dominant way of understanding suffering, whether we start to imagine that all suffering can actually be redressed, that we can find accountable agents for what we undergo, right? There are forms of illness, there are forms of anguish, there are forms of heartbreak for which there are no responsible subjects. And yet the notion of the subject emerges precisely in order to collapse or reduce suffering into accountability. And I think there are forms of suffering for which there is no accountability, or that we cannot explain. And indeed, maybe that's part of what happens in Kafka. There's suffering, there's a trace of guilt, but there is actually no bona fide guilty subject. There's the kind of scattering of it. I think it reopens the question of whether there's a certain kind of suffering that a juridical framework cannot imagine or cannot address. In the same way, maybe there's a certain kind of happiness that juridical redress cannot give us.
Cannot give us.
Like winning our court case is not finally satisfying. The satisfaction we might get from winning the court case is not what we want to call happiness. But if we're living in a world in which that juridical definition of satisfaction poses as happiness, we've lost something. So there's the question of what is outside the juridical frame in both cases. Yeah.
I would like to come back with the problem of punishment and the death penalty. I think the question was great. It was not a journalist question. And to be honest, I didn't like your answer so much. I think that the question was pointing out a core political element.
The question was?
Was excellent and was pointing out
a core political element.
Professor Agamben wrote in Homo Sacer, Imperium vitae nescisque potestas. That is to say, political power, the key element of political power, is the decision about life. If we talk about politics, we talk about a decision about the life. So I think that any political commitment has to face the problem of the life. My question in this moment should be, do you have any political commitment?
To be exact, this definition, which is a Roman law definition, refers not to polis but to law. Vita necisque potestas is a juridical Roman form, no? Referring to the juridical power of the sovereign to decide. So I was not at all saying that politics has to, biopolitics has to do with this in Foucault perspective. No, when life becomes the wager, what is at stake in the political system, then we have what Foucault called biopolitics. So I don't agree with your definition. Law, my point is that in law the question is the inclusion of life in the...
Political power, you know, the first fundamental of political power is a life that you can kill. Power, political power, is the decision about life.
Isn't it imperium? Yeah. But, okay, if I can add something here.
I think the problem with Eichmann is not a juridical problem, it's a political problem, because the law is the rationalized wish of the winner, and that is politics. And sovereignty, the power that is outside and inside the law, is in the, you know, it's a political decision. Law is a political decision, rationalized political decision, but it's impossible, in my opinion, to separate these two dimensions, law and politics. And this is the problem of
the model of politics depending on conceived as a decision life. It was precisely the model I was criticizing.
Yes.
With respect to Foucault, I said the problem of biopolitics is much more old. We found already in the beginning, in for instance, in Rome. But then this was the model I meant to criticize. I'm not saying politics is always a decision about life. This would be a decision of Nazi politics.
No, and let me put it to you in a different way. If I remember this argument correctly from both Foucault and from Agamben, the point was to think about those situations in which a sovereign decided who shall live and who shall die, and this was understood to be belonging to a previous organization of political power. But then when we move into modernity, and it looks as if at first we have surpassed that or overcome that, but actually we've moved into a different regime where the question is who will be left to die, or how do we understand those who are left to die, right? So there's not the sovereign making the explicit decision, you shall hang in public, or except apparently Arendt, who's still re-embodying the sovereign, who will say you must hang. It's kind of a great moment to read in light of Foucault. No, perfect. But through what forms of systematic negligence, or through what distributions of geopolitical power, do we find suddenly populations who are starving or who are left to die? Okay, so that's an analysis of how political power works, but it's not saying that if you want to be political, you must make the decision who lives and who dies.
What I'm saying, if you are going to challenge the political power, you have to assume, you have to face the problem of life, because if not, you are not doing politics.
I know, but you keep reinvoking a certain kind of sovereign decision maker who now will decide who lives and who dies, or who will be brave enough to say, yes, I'm in favor of the death penalty, or no, I'm against it for the following 18 reasons. And I think that you're rehabilitating the sovereign, and I actually think it's the dispersion of the sovereign which might be the most important political aim, which doesn't mean we don't debate such issues and come to positions on them, but if our status as political actors depends on our imitation of sovereign deciders, that would be a Schmidtian nightmare.
Maybe we should be Schmidt in another way. I don't know, probably this is a very difficult point, but if we think about Antigone, when Antigone challenged Creon, she decides about a life, her life. and she used her life, she took a decision about her life in order to challenge the political power. Even the bomber, the kamikaze, takes a decision about the key element in politics, the life, his life or her life. We can, in my opinion, establish another concept of politics. Politics is what we have, and law is what we have. And the sovereign, if the sovereign is the enemy, you can speak a different language. It's the sovereign who is establishing the rules of the game. And we can go away, go outside, and trying to play the game with other rules. And I think that the history of the liberation movements in the 20th century, in the 19th century, the history of the anti-colonization movement is the history of the political violence. I think it's so. The question about Eichmann is a political question. The decision about the life of a Nazi is not a problem of law or a moral problem, I think.
You know, I just want to know, do you think Antigone is a sovereign actor?
Gide said Antigone in this world would be considered a terrorist. Why?
Yes, I know, but, you know, it's almost as if you're saying that either we're truly political, either when we're willing to decide on life or death, or when we put our own life and death on the line. I mean, that seems pretty extreme. And I actually think we're sidestepping the question of what the specific organization of life is, right, at any given time and place. And what's the political organization of life, which is part of the question of biopolitics. And I feel like you're actually appealing to a vitalism that wants to sidestep the question that about how life is organized and whether we agree with the way in which it's organized. That takes us into a very different domain of politics. And then we're thinking about the distribution of resources. We're thinking about whose lives are considered livable or recognizable, or whose lives are protected by international law and whose lives are not. I mean, I think that you're moving into sovereignty and vitalism at a quick pace.
Yeah, both Antigone and the said bombers are obliged by sovereign power to act in this way. They are not at all. Antigone was obliged to do this. It's not, she's not killing herself. It's false.
There are different interpretations. That's
true. And the suicide bombers. So it's not true that you have to accept their point of view. This can be in a struggle, but it's not true. I mean, this must not be the political model you have on your mind. If you have this political model in your mind, there is no possible issue.
Also, I think I think we're actually dealing with very different conceptions of what life is, especially, you know, if you think about martyrdom and in so-called suicide bombing, you know, which life? The life here, the eternal life, the life of paradise? What are we talking about? I just think, we've got lots of different configurations going on. Look, I think there are all kinds of issues here. I'm sorry we've only had an hour to raise them without being able to pursue them. But I want to thank Giorgio and his class for joining us.